accounts are being criticised by MPs. Under the proposals, HM Revenue and Customs. Accountant Elaine Clark is worried innocent people could lose out to fraud and errors.
We live in a world where HMRC make mistakes. They don't get things right. And this proposal could result in an innocent person having money taken from their bank account and then having to fight HMRC to get that back.
Nigerian authorities have denied claims they failed to act on warnings about Boko Haram's raid on a boarding school in which more than 200 girls were kidnapped. Amnesty International says they knew about last month's attack hours before it happened. Fresh violence has broken out in southeastern Ukraine. More than 20 people are reported to have been killed in fighting between pro-Russian rebels and security forces. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
BCFM.
Unless we can be successful in creating a real free press where the American people get different viewpoints other than those expressed in the establishment-controlled media, there's going to be a civil war in this country, and it's going to come soon. The only thing that can stop it is by waking up vast amounts of sleeping people. Sheeple is what they are.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, it sounds like a joke, but the first ads are out there. How long until an American sheriff takes over Avon and Somerset Police? Plus, the Israelis and NATO are setting up a new regime change command centre in Amman, Jordan, aimed to topple the governments of Syria and Iran. But who decided that that's a good idea? Because it wasn't us. And on a similar theme, Putin tells East Ukrainian separatists not to hold their referendum or this weekend. But will they and should they take any notice of him? More too from last week's mind-boggling interviewee, that's US, Iraq and Ukraine wargame designer Joseph Miranda. This week he tells us about his game Battle for Baghdad that went down a storm at the Pentagon back in 2000. Also, with the US taking over Channel 5 TV this week, more from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom's Granville Williams on how the desire of a handful of corporations to control almost everything we read, see and hear is spreading to the internet too. But we start this week with the policing minister Damian Green's controversial proposals rolling out this spring and summer to recruit business chiefs and foreign police chiefs into Britain's top policing roles. For decades, promotion has been strictly from within the ranks and up from police constable. But that's all about to change. Avon and Somerset is one of the first to advertise three superintendent jobs, although their press statement has subsequently mysteriously disappeared from their website. So, to begin with, to discuss the wisdom or otherwise of direct entry into top policing jobs from Avon and Somerset branch of the Superintendents Association, I'm joined by Ian Wiley. Hi, Ian, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Just in time. Fantastic time. First of all, what is a superintendent?
Superintendent are the senior operational leaders within the police service. So a typical superintendent will have a what we call BCU, base command unit. So they will be in Bristol, for example. John Riley is the chief superintendent. His role is to oversee the operational policing across the city, and he's supported by a team of three superintendents who deliver the policing in conjunction with John, and they oversee the all of the policing, both uniform and CID.
And how long have you been doing the job for?
I've been a superintendent for nearly 7 years, and I've been a police officer for coming up to 19 years.
And how's the job changed?
I think the job, of course, you know, change is a constant within policing. And we have seen spans of command increase as we've gone through the the reduction in budgets for policing generally. So nationally across the piece, the peak in superintendent, chief superintendent numbers was back in about 2009, and we've seen a decline since then.
So the idea is that there's less superintendents, and so those that there are have got to stay in their job for longer. Is that right?
Well, we're still on a 30-year career at the moment, a pensionable career. Of course, that's changing under some of the new pension arrangements. So officers will be working for longer. But I think the point around direct entry is we are looking to modernise the police service, and the government have taken the view that by bringing in outstanding candidates from external organisations to join at superintendent rank is a positive step forward.
What about the process? Something called the Windsor process. What is the Windsor process, and how has it all come about?
Well, the direct entry process will bring officers in, direct entry at inspector, fast track to inspector level, but also at superintendent. As a superintendent's association, the association was initially sceptical and concerned about the process, primarily because of the operational command requirements that superintendents undertake. So, for example, firearms command, command of large public order incidents, those sorts of issues. However, the government have deemed it's an appropriate way forward, and the association is now working very closely with the College of Policing to ensure that those who join the service under this way are provided with the very best possible training and support. And in terms of Avon and Somerset locally, I was talking to Nick Gargan earlier today, that we've had 32 applicants for those three posts that you alluded to at the start of your piece, and there will now be work ongoing to determine which of those will progress to actual new recruits.
Now, I started off by saying US sheriffs moving in to take over Avon and Somerset Police. Is that feasible?
I think we're clearly it suits your headlines and listeners.
But I mean, why shouldn't one be successful in that process?
Well, police officers from other countries where they have a similar legal process as the UK, so for example Australia, Canada, may well be suitable applicants, but I think from the 32 that have applied, I understand there are a number from the private industry as well, and of course we would welcome high calibre candidates from across the piece, not just policing in other jurisdictions.
Well, tell us a bit about your career path. How did you become a superintendent? Did you start at the bottom as a PC?
Yeah, under the current arrangements, everyone is recruited as being a constable. I joined Kent Police in 1995. I spent 3.5 years as a constable. I was promoted to sergeant, and then in 2002 transferred over to Avon Somerset as an inspector, where I worked in various roles throughout Bristol, and then moved down into the county as a chief inspector, where I worked for a couple of years, and then in 2007 was promoted to a superintendent in Bristol. I was there for 4 years in various operational roles, and then in 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I was moved across to professional standards. So I was head of professional standards, which is the organisation that oversees the internal policing of the police, if you like. And then I've been in post in Somerset for the last 12 months.
Do you think there's a sort of bunker mentality, cabin fever in a way, in the police, in that the police are just simply working within themselves? I mean, there isn't enough. And do you think this is actually going to be a positive move, bringing in people from industry and from other parts of the world?
We do think it's a positive move, and the association now is very much working with the College of Policing to make this a success. The government have determined that's the way they want recruitment to go in future, and we are now determined to make this a success, and by working with the College of Policing we can ensure that the training and support that we provide and is provided to new colleagues under this system is as thorough as it possibly can be.
And as the Superintendents Association, how democratic are you as an organisation? Are you basically just told by whoever you've representing you at the top of the organisation, we're going to go with this, or is there been a very wide debate and an actual voting on whether to accept this or not?
Well, it's not a question of voting and whether accept it. The government have determined that this isn't a policy they want to introduce, and it's our job now as the senior operational leaders of the service to support that. So we're very much working with local forces and nationally with the College of Police policing to ensure that the new arrangements are as successful as they possibly can be?
Because the Police Federation have been on here and saying, for example, that they think it's not a good idea because what you may have is senior police officers with very little real experience of the decisions, how their decisions are actually affecting people on the ground, particularly, say, for example, in a control of a large public order incident.
Clearly, the training that we deliver will need to be absolutely spot on. And the other point really to raise is that we are looking for the very best candidates from external companies, wherever they may arrive from. We're looking for the very best people. And I think that combination, together with a really effective thorough training process, you know, should provide that capability. But of course, the proof in the pudding will be in the eating. But as an association, we are committed to supporting that.
Now, tell us a bit about your role as a superintendent. How have you? Because I know things have changed over the years with the Crown Prosecution Service taking on the role of actually deciding whether to take prosecutions forward. In the past, wasn't it the police that themselves that decided this? And I wonder how you think that has worked over the years. Because this is one of the things that the new people are going to have to be dealing with, isn't it?
It is. I mean, in all of my service, the CPS have made the decisions around who's taken to court and who isn't, and having that independence of view has been seen as a very positive step forward. There are some opportunities going forward for some of the lesser, more minor offences to be determined internally by the police service, but that's still under development. But certainly having the CPS as the prosecuting agency allows the police service to focus on gathering the evidence with then the views as to whether thresholds are met for prosecution being taken by the Crown Prosecution Service.
Now, they've got this something called the College of Policing. I don't know if it's something you know about, but it's certainly an article I've got from The Guardian towards the end of the last year says that this College of Policing is going. The idea is that if someone is a winning candidate, that they can go there and get a fast track. But surely, Ian, there's no way that a course, whether it's a month or 2 months or a few weeks there, is going to be able to equip people to do the job that actually there are many officers with a lifetime experience could do a lot better.
Well, I think there's several issues there. Firstly, the College of Policing is a new professional body for the police service, and it will be a professional body for everyone from constable right through to chief constable and all the ranks in between, and also represent police staff members. So it's about a professional body for policing, and I think it's only right that body takes on the responsibility for delivering the courses that will equip these high calibre, small number of individuals and take them through to being a successful superintendent. As I said to you earlier, the proof in the pudding will be in the eating in terms of the success that those people bring to the role.
Another problem that the Police Federation brought up when they were in here was the possibility that people from the area of business might be too close to the business community in the city and might not be listening as closely maybe as you would to the requirements of the population of ordinary people.
I think any superintendent's role is to ensure that we are delivering on behalf of the public. You'll be aware that we elected PCCs into every force.
These are the police commissioners.
Police and crime commissioners. And in this force, Sue Mount Stevens is the PCC, and she sets the very clear view on what the priorities will be for the police force to follow. And it's our role as senior operational leaders to ensure that we deliver that. I think it would be unreasonable to suggest that somebody coming in for business would have a different set of priorities. Clearly, they would be working within the priorities set by the organisation.
I mean, say, for example, the boss of Tesco's. I mean, why would he be the right sort of person to do your job? He's got no experience of it.
He might bring a few good strap lines with him. You know, every little helps. But this really is about getting the most high-calibre candidates into the police service. And the bigger issue here is that the police service currently recruits, as I was recruited and as our current chief constable was recruited, we're recruited as a competent PC. And then we, through the experience, we then progress through the ranks. Now, the view has been taken by the government that actually a new approach to recruitment will shake up the leadership of the service and provide a broad-based leadership base. So direct entry at superintendent and also fast-track at inspector will provide a different view of leadership over the coming years. Now, whether that's successful or not, as I said to you earlier, will be shown over time. But we, as an association, are committed to supporting it.
And what about China? There's nothing to stop a Chinese police chief applying for one of these jobs, is there? Maybe taking your job.
Well, I understand the limiting factors within the legislation is that somebody must come from a jurisdiction where policing is a similar vein. And I think we'd probably agree that some of the activities in China wouldn't fit the jurisdictions of, say, Australia or Canada.
Okay, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, can I just bring you in here? There is a clear difference between the way that the Police Federation are looking at this and the Superintendents Association. But what's your view on what difference it will make if people from industry, people from police services in other parts of the world are able to come into jobs like Ian's and into maybe even a chief constable's job?
Well, I think I understand what Ian's saying is because this has been decided by the government. He's not really in a position to argue with it. I mean, if he was, then people would be saying, well, that's not right because you've got to do, you know, basically he's under orders from further up. But I think there is legitimate concern. I would worry that people who are coming in from outside the police service simply won't have the respect of frontline officers because they haven't been doing the sort of things that they've been doing. And as you say, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. Personally, I rather like the British system where you have to start at the bottom as a police constable and work your way up. I mean, that was the system for many years, and to change it, I mean, obviously the government wants to change it. Whether it's the right decision is another matter.
What about that particular point, Ian? Because you've really got to keep PCs on side, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, there's just two points there, really. And in terms of being under orders, that certainly isn't the case. As an association, we are independent, and we do take the view, as the senior operational leaders, that our job is to support the professional development of policing. We did actually oppose the plans initially and made our views quite well known to government. But having been implemented, it's our job now to ensure that they are supported to the 100% and to make sure that the training that this small group of people are given is as effective and comprehensive as possible. In relation to officers having respect for those new senior officers, I think respect is something that's earned, and if people coming in from industry can demonstrate they've got the capability to deliver in whatever environment they're asked to as a superintendent, then I think they will attract that respect from their colleagues. Of course, there will be those who are cynical and concerned that they won't be able to deliver. But if you look at other industry, you know, there are clear precedents for people coming in at a more senior level. On Wednesday evening this week, I was at 40 Commando in Taunton in the officers' mess with young officers, all in their early 20s, who were lieutenants and captains, some of whom hadn't been in the organisation very long at all, but they'd been through a comprehensive training programme that met the needs of the commandos. I'm not suggesting that it's exactly the same, but there are clearly parallels between how other industry attracts the very best talent. And again, as an association, we're keen to support that.
But do you recognise the problem with morale there is in the police? Kevin Phillips from the Police Federation, when he was in here, was saying that morale is actually really low at the moment. And the idea that people in the lower echelons of the police are going to be passed over for promotion, people are going to be brought in from outside when actually they feel they're quite capable of doing those jobs, is going to be another blow to morale. And actually, surely, the police service really functions largely, as successful or otherwise, on its morale.
I think we've got to avoid being narrow-minded and sort of, you know, a little bit nimbyistic in terms of how we view this. I think if we see it as a real opportunity, I work with some of the best, most talented leaders. And I chair the Regional Superintendents Association, and I've seen some of the best, most talented superintendents and chief superintendents who will compete against the best talent from outside. And I think we should welcome the opportunity to show just how good we are. And when people start comparing us to the outside talent, they'll find that those working internally are just as capable.
Okay, Ian Wiley from the Superintendents Association, Avon and Somerset Police, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're going over to have a look at the news from Ukraine and old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. We've had the news, haven't we, from Vladimir Putin this week that he thinks that they shouldn't have these referendums in the east of Ukraine and should wait for the parliamentary elections later in the month.
Well, no, he said that what he actually said was that presidential elections should be delayed.
Presidential elections,
yes,
sorry,
and
yeah.
Also that these people shouldn't necessarily have their referendums. And I think that rather puts the lie to the Western propaganda that all of these people are being put up to what they're doing by Putin. Because Putin, in fact, is telling them to hold their horses. And in actual fact, their response to that has been, who the hell is Putin? So I think that shows people are beginning in the West to get some sense of the complexity of the situation, because we've been presented with a fairly black and white Putin bad, Russia terrible point of view up to now, and this is a very dangerous situation, and everybody needs to take a step back and take and count to 10.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to Vladimir Putin speaking the Russian president earlier this week on Wednesday.
We ask the representatives of southeastern Ukraine and pro-federalization supporters to postpone the referendum on the region's autonomy, scheduled for the 11th of May this year. When our colleagues in Europe and the US drive the situation into deadlock, they shift responsibility onto Moscow. Those who committed the coup and those who supported these actions shall hold responsibility for the situation in Ukraine. Those who supported these actions financially, politically, and through media and other means have driven the situation to the tragedy that took place in Odessa.
Well, Putin is there pointing the finger at the people behind the coup in Kiev as the people who've created the crisis. And I think fundamentally he's right. But the Western media, the mainstream media, not BCFM of course, are essentially banging a Cold War drum and blaming the Russians for the crisis. And there doesn't seem to be any understanding that the government that came to power in Kiev is in fact the police and the military are under the control of far-right Nazi parties. I mean, I say Nazi and advisedly. These are the people that supported the German invasion of the Soviet Union in the 1940s. But these parties are the same parties. Yeah? They are not just a little bit right-wing like UKIP. And of course, the other thing is that as Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, pointed out, the evidence from the telephone intercept between Catherine Ashton and Umas Pietz, the Estonian foreign minister, is that the shooting of the protesters was carried out by elements within the current government, not the Yanukovych government. So what actually was happening was Yanukovych didn't want to sign up to this deal with the EU because it would have involved, for example, putting lots of people out of work in East Ukraine. And eventually he said, well, I'm not going to sign up for this. I'd rather go with a deal from the Russians, which will allow me to keep these people to keep their jobs. Underlying all of this is the economic policy that's going to be pursued. If they pursue a shock therapy policy, people in the East Ukraine will definitely be the losers. People in the West Ukraine will also be losers, but they are deluded in believing that they will join the EU and become rich. A, they're not going to join the EU. There's no possibility of them joining the EU in any reasonable time frame. So that's just silly. It's a carrot that doesn't exist. And the stick is all too real. They are increasing people's energy bills, and they're cutting their social benefits. And I think the people in the West Ukraine will find that intolerable. People in the East Ukraine have already concluded that it is intolerable. So this is very much brinkmanship by the United States in particular, and I suspect that NATO's underground Gladio structures were behind the shootings in the Maidan Square, which precipitated the coup. So these people came to power in Kiev on a tide of blood. And therefore, Obama referred to them the other day as the duly elected government, that just gets a snort in Moscow.
Now, in The Independent this week, Kim Sengupta on Monday published an article entitled "Ukraine Crisis: Mercenaries, Ready Meals, and MI6." The evidence, inverted commas, of British troops are fighting pro-Russian troops, or something less sinister, ? So Kim Sengupta is saying that the snipers on that very hill were British. People have seen them. He's quoting one of the locals there. You could tell by their uniforms. Vitali Netovich said with confidence, they were by the television tower, but even before they were stationed, there were others who came in by helicopter. And there are MREs, meals ready to eat, a staple of US forces on combat missions in the brown packets, familiar to many of us from Iraq. And he shows a photograph of these in the article. And Afghanistan, clearly marked made in USA, issued by the Department of Defense. Also there, lying amid bloodstains, body parts, and a body yet to be taken away, were NATO 5.56mm cartridges as used in the US military's M16 rifles. I'm not saying the foreigners did the killings, but they were here, insisted Mr. Velovich, a 45-year-old farmer. Now, is also there were NATO uniforms left there because the people who'd been shooting from there had changed into civilian clothes. Martin?
Well, at the very beginning of the crisis, as I've said before, the shooting of the protesters in the Maidan Square, the prima facie evidence is that was carried out by elements within the current government, specifically UNA, UNSO, who are a Ukrainian paramilitary formation. But those Ukrainian paramilitary, right-wing paramilitary formations have a long-standing relationship with NATO special forces. And it may well be that that mercenaries are being involved. One of the problems that the government in Kiev has had is that they've sent the army into the East Ukraine to restore order, as they see it, and the army has defected to the protesters, handed over their weapons. The Ukrainian navy, for example, virtually deserted en masse to the Russian navy. So what they're now doing is sending Pravi sector paramilitaries, right-wing paramilitaries, and Western mercenaries into East Ukraine, and it was right wing paramilitaries that burned down the trade union headquarters in Odessa, which killed at least 40 people and possibly up to 100 people. And of course, things like that are bloody Sundays. The East Ukrainians are now saying, "Well, we can't possibly be ruled from Kiev if they're going to send these kind of right wing paramilitaries to kill us."
It does seem a bit like some kind of provocation designed to evoke a response, but that's not the most sensible thing to do in the run up to these presidential elections.
Well, the point is that what may well happen, don't forget that one of the goals of NATO and the West here may be, or rather the dark forces within those structures, is just to turn Russia into an enemy state. Because basically, Russia and Germany in particular are developing a very strong economic relationship, an economic relationship which excludes the United States of America. So a deal was done on the morning of the coup between Yanukovych and the various leaders of the opposition parties and three representatives of the European Union. And a deal was done that there would be an early presidential election and a government of national unity. They all left that meeting, and then suddenly the snipers started shooting both police officers and protesters. And the phone call which was intercepted points the finger very firmly at the current government, the right-wing government in Kiev, working hand in hand with NATO to shoot people. People say, well, NATO doesn't shoot protesters. And I say, NATO does shoot protesters. There is a track record going back decades. The Gladio networks of NATO bombed Bologna railway station in 1980, killing 80-odd people. They were involved in the kidnap of the Italian Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, all of which has been uncovered by police action in Italy and mentioned in Fernando Imposimato's book, he being the head of the Italian Supreme Court. So, to my mind, the idea that NATO may have killed people in order to provoke a war is a perfectly straightforward idea, and I'm sure it's perfectly straightforward for the Russian general staff to take that on board as well.
Okay.
That's how dangerous this situation is.
Today, Putin makes his first visit to Crimea for a military parade, as the US is sending commandos to the Baltics. Again, in the Independent, President Putin made his first visit to Crimea today since Russia annexed the region. It is believed he will attend a military parade in Sevastopol to mark 69 years since the Soviet victory over Nazi Germany, which occupied Crimea for 2 years during World War II. He was present at a similar event in the capital's Red Square this morning, which gave Moscow an opportunity to flex its military muscles as the worst relations between the Russia and the West since the Cold War are enduring amid continued instability in eastern Ukraine. His visit to Crimea and accompanying military parade come as the US prepares to send hundreds of commandos to the Baltic states over the coming months as part of an ongoing effort to reassure its allies in the region. Well, it's not just been sending them from the United States, Martin. It's also been moving them from other parts of Europe to that part of the world.
Yes, and this is an extremely dangerous situation because but the problem is on the ground in these rather obscure places in East Ukraine, people could start killing each other just because they're fed up with what's facing them, and then the superpowers could be dragged in to a major war on the back of it. It's brinkmanship of an extraordinarily dangerous kind, and I think that the Western media has been completely complicit in pushing a very one-sided view of all of this. I'll repeat it again. We have a telephone intercept which points the finger directly at the current government for the shootings in the Maidan Square.
On that subject, the appeal not to forget the people who defeated fascism from Putin in Red Square today did, however, have a poignant ring as Moscow warned of the dangers posed by leaders it portrays as neo-fascists in Ukraine and has urged Europe to prevent the rise of the far right. He delivered the speech to soldiers and war veterans after watching troops, tanks, artillery and mobile ballistic missile launchers far past him and jet fighters scream overhead. The iron will, he said, of the Soviet people, their fearlessness and stamina saved Europe from slavery. It was our country which chased the Nazis to their lair, achieved their full and final destruction, won at the cost of millions of victims and terrible hardships, he said. Well, he's not talking about the American war effort there, Martin, is he?
No, and don't forget that the Pravi Sector and Svoboda in the Ukrainian government, running both the military and the police, are directly descended from pro-German Ukrainian formations. And that's not surprising that the Russian-speaking population are not happy with these kind of people. And they turned up in Odessa, as we saw last week, throwing petrol bombs, killing scores of people.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Syrian rebels tunnel under Aleppo frontline to bomb a government hotel. Martin, related, of course, to the situation in Ukraine because of the prominence of the Russian Black Sea Fleet in stopping attacks on Syria last summer. But this looks like the end game is coming in to focus now for the civil war in Syria, as the Syrian government is taking back many of the major cities that have been held by the rebels. We heard a year or so ago, maybe even 2 years ago, that Assad's days are numbered, but it looks like there's going to be an election there soon, and it doesn't look like he's going anytime soon.
No. The situation, obviously, people's attention has moved from Syria to Ukraine because that seems to be the more immediate threat to world peace. But the government forces seem to be winning the war inside Syria at great price to the population. But I fear that this is going to drag on and on, and that the second best outcome for the Western powers and Israel is for the war in Syria to just drag on and make it difficult.
Well, the Islamist Front said it had chosen Thursday to carry out the bombing, that's yesterday, in order to send a message that the revolution remained alive despite the government taking back full control of the strategic city of Homs.
Well, I mean, Western powers are still supplying weaponry to their protégés inside Syria. And as I've mentioned before, Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, was on French television last year, and he said that before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials at an international meeting, and they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Are you interested in participating? So it may well be that MI6 took the lead in setting up an armed insurrection in Syria. Now, if that is the case, that means that that the British, in particular, are responsible for the thousands of dead that we've seen and the many millions of others that have been displaced.
Also, in the same region, Tehran is saying, this is the FARS news, F-A-R-S news, their English service, is saying that CIA, Mossad, MI6 and their Arab Gulf allies are setting up a joint operation room in Amman in Jordan, the purpose of which is regime change. They both want to work, all those agencies want to work towards overturning the governments of Syria and Iran. The source said that the war on Syria, the operations of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, also known as ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq, the recent clashes between the Egyptian army and people, unrest and terrorist bomb attacks in Lebanon which aim to weaken Hezbollah and invigorate terrorist groups in Yemen, have been the products of this joint operation room, and it's now been put into Jordan.
Yes, and in actual fact, it's become quite clear through the Syrian crisis that the Western intelligence services do work with Islamic extremists who are aligned with Al-Qaeda. So there's no doubt about it, they were definitely supplying them with weaponry and training. and the Iranians and the Syrians are not very happy about that. Why would they be?
Okay, also we have a final story on the on our international stuff. A humanitarian intervention in Nigeria. Is the Boko Haram insurgency another CIA covert operation? This is by Atheling Reginald Maviringa, from Nigeria. Haven't seen him on Newsnight. He's saying, we have already been regaled with reports provided by WikiLeaks, which identify the US embassy in Nigeria as a forward operating base for far and wide reaching acts of subversion against the Nigerian government, which include but not limited to eavesdropping on Nigerian government communications, financial espionage on leading Nigerians, support and funding of subversive groups and insurgents, sponsoring divisive propaganda amongst the disparate groups of Nigeria, and the use of visa blackmail to induce and coerce high-ranking Nigerians into acting in favour of US interests. Now, the Boko Haram horrific kidnapping, what he's implying in this is that actually this could be just a little wing of AFRICOM, you know, part of the United States African Command.
Yes, well, I mean, look at what's happened in Syria. We've just been talking about Syria. Now, the pattern is this, and this people have got to understand. NATO works with fascists in Ukraine, with Islamists in Syria, and possibly covertly with Boko Haram in Nigeria to create chaos, and then say, oh, you've got chaos there, you need us to come and help you resolve this problem. You've got a problem with Islamic extremism, you need us to come in there. The SAS are being talked about, are being sent off to Nigeria, whatever. Now, of course, AFRICOM was set up by the Americans to protect Africa, but no African country wanted them to be based in Africa at all, so we don't need protection. So it's actually based in Stuttgart. But ultimately, the Americans and NATO want to control Africa. So what happens is, they encourage the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example, which is part of Al-Qaeda, to overthrow Gaddafi. And then, of course, further mushrooms grow up in Mali and other places. And in Yemen, we've got the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula set up by two former inmates of Guantanamo Bay. Now, if people haven't got this yet, they should really get their heads around it. Al-Qaeda and all of these extremist Muslim groups are being orchestrated by NATO special forces. They've been orchestrated. This has been going on for decades.
Well, we hear in New York as well this week, and this is in the Telegraph, Abu Hamza secretly worked for MI5 to keep the streets of London safe. That sort of corroborates what you're saying about these intelligence services, Martin. Yeah. Abu Hamza, the radical Islamic preacher notorious for his hate-filled sermons, was in reality working secretly with British intelligence to keep the streets of London safe by cooling the hotheads, his lawyer claimed in a US court this week. Holding up what he said were reports from Scotland Yard. Joshua Drittel described the cleric as an intermediary who cooperated with MI5 and the police to try and end foreign hostage takings and diffuse tensions with the Muslim community in Britain. The extraordinary admission will fuel conspiracy theories that he was allowed to preach hatred without arrest for so long in the UK. The first attempts to rein him in were actually done by the mosque calling the police back in 1997 because he was working with the security authorities. Now, it's very easy for MI5 to say we had nothing to do with this guy. He clearly thinks he was talking to them, and it does seem to explain the reason why he was left for something like 7, 8, 9 years to do this hate preaching in Finsbury Park Mosque, even though the people who ran the mosque didn't want him there.
Yes, and Operation Cyclone, in which MI6 was the lead agency, was the name of the operation which moved Islamic extremists from all over the Middle East to fight in Afghanistan after having been trained by Western Special Forces.
He claimed that back in 2006, Abu Hamza, that he was told by MI5 that he could continue to preach hate as long as we don't see blood on the streets of London.
Well, I mean, it may be worse than that, is that they're quite happy for him to preach hate because he becomes a hate figure, and that's what we want to see. So Boko Haram, Abu Hamza, the mastermind of the 7/7 bombings,
Harun
Ashwat, who is now in
Broadmoor.
If people can't remember what happened yesterday, but they need an understanding of history. The Islamic extremist groups which were funneled into Afghanistan in the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister of Britain. Many of them were trained by British Special Forces, and at that stage they were all heroes and fighting the godless communists, and it was all wonderful. And that is the relationships between Al-Qaeda and the Western intelligence services are intimate and have always been intimate. As Robin Cook said when he was Foreign Secretary, the word Al-Qaeda simply means the base, the database, a database held in Jordan of all the people recruited from all over the Middle East, but particularly from Benghazi in Libya to fight in Afghanistan. And they were all trained by Western Special Forces.
Martin, do you think that the NATO intelligence, the CIA and MI6 and Mossad sitting down there in Amman, Jordan now, are going to succeed in overthrowing the Iranian government and the Syrian government?
Well, what looks like happening on the ground is that the Syrian government, Hezbollah, militias coming in from Iraq who are pro the Maliki government, and of course with Russian coordination, they are actually fighting as a team. But what you've got on the other side is that each different part of the coalition is supporting different rebel groups inside Syria, so that the Qataris will be supporting different people from the Saudis, who will be supporting different people from the British. But of course, I come back to what I said earlier about the French foreign minister, who said that the British were actually planning an armed uprising in Syria before the Arab Spring began. Now, in other words, NATO is up to its usual tricks in Ukraine, in Syria and elsewhere. War is their business. They're not a defensive structure. NATO, in fact, is the biggest warmongers on the planet, along with their Al-Qaeda allies.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
And one of the places that NATO may be getting their ideas for the next war on is from US war game designer Joseph Miranda, because I spoke to him a few weeks ago, and he told me about his game he invented in 2000 called Battle for Baghdad.
I did Battle for Baghdad, which is a multiplayer simulation of the struggle to gain control of the capital of Iraq in recent years. And that's proven to be a lot of fun. It's played a lot at conventions, and I've even seen it played in higher level army headquarters. So it's gotten around.
Well, you say fun, Joseph, but I mean, there's a war crimes aspect to this as well, isn't it? Because a lot of people are pointing their fingers at Bush and Blair and people like that, and saying, "Well, that war was illegal."
Right. This is war gaming. We're just gamers here.
But don't you think, to a certain extent, the real military do these sort of games, and that with something like Iraq, they would probably have gamed it beforehand, and if they think they can win, I mean, this gives them the impetus to go ahead and do something that they might not otherwise do. So in a way, you're kind of encouraging them.
Well, I wish I had that kind of power. Actually, wargaming has often been ignored. Prior to the war in Vietnam, the U.S. actually did a series of war games called the Signal War Games, and they demonstrated that the U.S. strategy for Vietnam was going to fail, and these games were ignored, and the strategy that was used was essentially the losing strategy in the game. So I think the same thing might have been true for Iraq. Had they paid more attention to the gamers, they might have seen that, well, wait a minute, this isn't going to work out the way we think it's going to work out.
That's US war game designer Joseph Miranda there. But Martin, I mean, there is a serious element to this, isn't there? Because exercises, war games are always taking place around the world, and it's here that many of the militaries explore what's possible and what isn't.
Well, the no doubt the military would carry on making war games, whether amateurs design their war games or not. The military war game automatically. I mean, in actual fact, in the run-up to the Iraq war, there was a war game where the U.S. Marine colonel who was playing Saddam Hussein sank the whole invasion fleet with suicide speedboats before they got anybody ashore. And the game only lasted about half a day, and then they had to sack him, and they then got their police people ashore. And he said that's not going to happen like that. In actual fact, it ruined his career. But what he was doing was right.
Why did it ruin his career? Because I mean, surely he's been a successful general or whatever.
Because what he was doing was telling them what they didn't want to hear, which is this is going to be a lot more complicated than you think it is. Which is the point that was being made by the war games designer there. That if they'd actually played the game through properly and thought through the implications, then that might have discouraged them. So what tends to happen, of course, is the game itself allows people people to consider what the options are. But of course, the push for war is coming from people who are not that bothered to think about that. They just want their war, and you know, in effect, you know, playing it as a game might discourage people from doing it in reality. That's the purpose of playing games, isn't it?
Okay. Any thoughts about you know, the how things are going in Ukraine? Because obviously there are when we discussed the game about Ukraine last week. But what are your thoughts about the next couple of weeks and the whether it's wise to have referenda, elections, and that sort of thing? How's this going to settle out, do you think?
Well, I think what should be becoming clear to people in the West is that Putin is not, in fact, encouraging these people in East Ukraine to do what they're doing. They're doing it because they want to do it for their own reasons.
They're looking across at Odessa, aren't they?
Indeed. I mean, once the Pravi sect have killed all those people, you can imagine a lot of people are very upset about that, and they don't really want to be governed by people who are. I mean, the Pravi sect are in the government of Kiev, in the Kiev government, and their militants were responsible for killing all of these people. It's bound to create tension, isn't it? But. It may be that the West is now starting to get a more balanced view of the situation. I hope Western public opinion is getting a more balanced view, although incredibly enough, the killings in Odessa are being spun as, oh, just unfortunate, people were killed, and yeah,
they weren't reported as being of killings of trade unionists, and it wasn't reported as a trade union headquarters.
Well, I mean, what they were saying is that there were clashes and people got killed, as if there was no... But in actual fact, that there was actually a peaceful protest camp outside the trade union headquarters. The Pravi sector militants turned up armed to the teeth and immediately attacked the peaceful... And, of course, they're not necessarily from Odessa. They were brought in from West Ukraine, from places like Lvov. And they attacked these peaceful protesters, who then ran into the trade union building to escape from being attacked. The trade union building was set on fire, and as people tried to get out of the trade union building,
well, they jumped. They were then
attacked by this right wing mob once they'd left the building. Now, this to me looks very similar to what happened in Belfast and Derry in 1969, where the communities basically went to war with the police on one side rather than the other. And of course, that ended up as it ended up. I think Putin doesn't really want a conflict in Ukraine, and I think the West suggesting that he does is misunderstanding his position completely. He wants the whole thing to be calmed down. Basically, it's in his interest for it to calm down. He wants to carry on doing business with the West. He's not a fool. He's an intelligent guy, and he's trying to calm the situation down. He should be encouraged in that by the West instead of being told that he's an evil dictator and blah and blah. Evil dictator with 80% public opinion behind him.
Well, he's due to come over for the D-Day anniversary. I think it's 70 years, isn't it, since D-Day. Mm-hmm. Do you think that'll all go smoothly? I'm not even sure if he's going to be talking to Obama and Cameron and people like that at the D-Day celebrations.
Well, one hopes that the people in charge are sensible enough to realise that we don't need a civil war in Ukraine that drags in the rest of Europe in its wake. For goodness sake, let's not do that. Let's everybody... There's clearly very strong passions and opinions now in Ukraine. People on both sides feel that they've been attacked by the other side. They've lost friends and relatives. They're upset. The potential for this to escalate is always there. Let's not escalate it.
And I should say, D-Day commemoration, not celebration.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, we heard last week that a US company is going to be taking over Channel 5 TV and the campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom's Granville Williams. We're going to hear from him now on how the desire of a handful of corporations to control almost everything we read, see and hear is spreading to the internet too. Political parties and our MPs don't really run things, and actually some of these big media corporations really can call the shots. This is not just an illusion that they are able to determine policy in a very undemocratic way.
Yeah. Well, I think we've seen examples of this in key legislation, and remember, there will have to be a new kind of Communications Act in the UK, whichever government is elected in 2015, and what we will see deployed is exactly the same lobbying by big media corporations as we see with Google and Amazon at a European and international level to ensure that they get the right policy outcome. And against that, we have to mobilise the society, if you want, the people that are the consumers of these news and in entertainment media groups, and to say, look, there are issues here. We saw them highlighted at the time of the Leveson inquiry, the absolute collusion between politicians and media. Now, that was exposed, and that led to a groundswell of awareness by people. And in the next election, the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom is going to mount what I hope will be an effective campaign to make the media an election issue, to actually alert people to say, look, are you aware that 75% of the UK media is owned by groups, newspaper groups, hate trade unions, pursue a policy which actually supports the kind of low-wage, zero-hours world that we've moved into.
To what extent, though, is there actually collusion amongst those groups, and, you know, maybe Murdoch sitting down with the Telegraph and saying, well, we're adopting this policy? Because that really would be worrying, almost like a cartel of media, big media.
No, they share a common world view. You don't need to collude if you share a common world view. And what's the common world view? That Murdoch, the Barclay brothers, Lord Rothermere and Richard Desmond share? They're ruthless about the people they employ. You either sign up to the worldview I have or you don't stay with me. And it's almost like a cult that you are at. If you work on these sorts of organisations, you have to accept the value system, and that's it. So it's not some kind of, you know, conspiracy. It's the way the world works, that the editors and the proprietors will have a shared view. And that view, I mean, the example, I spoke to some Manchester University students and I showed them the front pages from the papers like The Express, The Mail, and the quality papers, The Telegraph, The Times, and they were the coverage of the run-up to when you could, Bulgarians and Romanians could come into the UK in January 2014. And their coverage was that there would be millions and millions of Bulgarians and Romanians coming across. In one case, the one paper quoted the figure for the population, the figures that they were quoting, the population of Romania is smaller than the figure they were quoting, and they've taken the propaganda, if you want, from Nigel Farage UKIP leaflet. But the point about these students, they looked at these front pages of these newspapers, they were shocked. I said, you don't see these papers, do you? And I thought, they don't see them because it's not part of their world. The people who read these papers, remember, 75% of newspapers by circulation in the UK, the people who read them are the ones who, in the end, form a world view. Over time, it's not some kind of sort of hypnotic influence. It's a world view that's shaped over time, which is actually about the hostility towards immigration, and a world view about people in this country. If you're poor, you're a benefit seeker, a scrounger, or whatever. You should be in work, and it filters through. It's not journalism that is in these papers. It's a kind of narrow propaganda, often made up. And my example I would give you is a Mail Online piece that went out in December 2013, saying that all flights to the UK from Romania had been booked up, all coach trips had been booked up, and a journalist, to his credit, a man called John Danzig, contacted another journalist in Romania and said, would you check this? This is what they're saying. What they found were 13 examples, either where no company existed that they claimed. It was a normal end of the Christmas holiday time. They claimed that people were paying the equivalent of £3,000 for seats on the plane. There was no such price.
What you say about the students, surely there lies some hope, because these young people, a lot of them don't get their news from these traditional methods. Actually, a lot of them don't watch television either. They don't trust television. They use the internet to get the information they want. They're quite selective. Yeah. So is there really some hope there?
When I spoke with the students, they were in obviously, by definition, they come along to a meeting which was there to discuss the media and to discuss corporate lobbying. And they were obviously interested, but there were about 100 students there, I know that there must be about 20 to 30,000 students at Manchester University. So there's hope for the students who turned up. I'm not sure what that means for the other students at the university. But the message that we're trying to get across is that you need to get involved in the democratic process. You need to look at what's going to happen in the European elections. You've got vote, make your mind up on who you vote for, but think about it too, because the dominant message you're getting is a kind of amplified message through the news media, and because it's in the news media all the time, politicians then have to respond to it, and then broadcasters respond to it.
Okay, so what about the future, the balance of power between the media and politicians, elected politicians here in Britain?
Yeah, well, I think if I'm honest, there has been a collusive relationship between politicians and the media, and I can't see that ending in the future, because many of the people who now go into Parliament, I see today that one of Blair's sons might get a seat in Parliament. That prospect fills me with terror, because these are the same people that play by the same rules. I think we need to try and get a new kind of we need new kinds of politicians who actually say, you have a job to do in the media, but I'm not going to be made subservient, in the words of the Labour MP, by having to accept some kind of favourable treatment from you. We have a role to do, and I actually think politicians have got to stand up to the media. They need to say, we're going to regulate you. We want a press regulation which is effective, not the present Press Complaints Commission. We need rules on media ownership to limit the power of some of these awful groups to promote their propaganda. It's not journalism. Now, if it was I mean, I have no problem with somebody arguing clearly and coherently that the European project is a failed project. I have no problem with that. If it's argued editorially, but in your reporting, you're presenting the facts and information in a reasonably balanced way. And we don't see that. I mean, I'll give you one example. I spoke to some Norwegian journalists recently, and I gave them three examples of how events in Brussels and activities and reports, which I was involved with, were reported in the UK press. And it was a caricature. It was unrecognisable reporting. And they were shocked, because in places like Norway, their newspapers actually respect their readers and will give them good journalism.
That is Granville Williams there. So it's Tony Gosling here, and saying goodbye now. And doesn't look like any Cyrus the Virus up next, but you'll find us online at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Don't let those banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, photographs have emerged which appear to show at least one UK with a dead Taliban fighter. The pictures are alleged to have been taken at the main British base in Afghanistan, Camp Bastia, after an attack by insurgents in September 2012. Our reporter Anushka Astana says the RAF has issued a statement.
They've said inappropriate actions will not be tolerated in the armed forces. The RAF is treating this incident extremely seriously and has launched a military police investigation. As this incident is subject to an ongoing investigation, it would be inappropriate to comment further at this time.
The trial of TV star Rolf Harris on charges of indecent assault has started. The jury was told by the prosecution that one of his alleged victims